morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Carrie Hertz. She's a photographer whose new book is called New Mexico's Crypto Juice, Image and Memory. Right now, I'd like to welcome, joining us by telephone from Paris, France, Bill Burke White. He's our foreign correspondent. He's a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be back with you.
Great to have you here as well. We are just going to do a little roundup. It's almost the new year. Let's look at the world in review. How are we doing now compared to a year ago, for example, in Iraq?
Well, it's been a big year in foreign affairs, and I think on net, the world may actually look a little better today than it did a year ago. And Iraq is perhaps one of those things that has made the world look a little better, not to say that there aren't real problems in Iraq, but one of the things that has happened in the last 3 to 5 months is that the level of violence in Iraq has declined in terms of the number of killings, the number of roadside bombs, and so forth, peaked about, you know, early summer, and has been on the decline, which is certainly a good thing both for, you know, U.S. Service members who are in Iraq and also for the Iraqi people. And we've started to see some level of return of some of the Iraqis who had left and gone, for example, as refugees to Jordan and elsewhere. So that's a good sign.
Now, hang on a second, Bill. Is that better security situation due to the so-called surge?
Well, you'll remember that the president sent about 20,000 additional troops to Iraq in the spring and summer, and I don't think we can attribute very much of the change in Iraq to the troop surge. Frankly, 20,000 additional troops is not enough to make a meaningful difference in terms of the security in Iraq. It's a huge country, and 20,000 troops really doesn't go very far. I think there are a couple of things that are different. One may be how we're using the troops that are there. General David Petraeus, who is now commanding the U.S. forces in Iraq, has taken, I think, a more forward-looking strategy, has really sent the troops that we do have out into communities in an effort to try to secure some of them and go block by block in some towns, sort of projecting a security zone, and that's a good thing. And the Iraqi military is able to do more than it was a year ago. It's far from perfect, but we're partnering with them out in these sort of remote stations that have been set up, remote being farther from a main U.S. base. So that may have something to do with it, but I think really it's a question of politics, and this is where the reason for real concern in Iraq is still there. The only way that you end the violence, and I think part of the reason we've seen a decline in violence, is by getting a meaningful political settlement. And there has been some movement in terms of political settlement in Iraq, but we're still a very long way from there. And I think what we've actually seen is that some of the insurgents have paused, in a sense, to see where the political debate goes in Iraq. And that those insurgents will still be there to come back in a more violent way if there's not a political settlement. And what we have not seen thus far is a willingness of the Iraqi government to step up to the plate and find a solution of the both ethnic issues between Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds and the sort of broader political issues as to who's going to have power and who's going to have access to energy resources. And my fear is that if we just think, the violence has declined in Iraq, we don't have to worry about it anymore, we're missing the fact that the underlying politics have not yet been solved. And if they aren't solved, I think we could see a return to the levels of violence we had earlier in the year, or even worse, if the political process doesn't produce some meaningful solutions soon.
What do the people of Iraq want?
Well, the problem is there is no people of Iraq to ask that question of. Obviously, the ordinary people who live in Iraq would like to see violence stop. The problem is if you ask in different parts of the country or different ethnic groups, what they want in terms of a political outcome looks very different. The Kurds, who are up in the north and have probably the most stable, government and the safest, situation in terms of security, want to kind of maximize their independence, but also want to make sure that they get some share of the massive oil wealth lying under parts of Iraq. And then the Shiites and Sunnis, I think, each have very different views of the degree to which the state ought to be dominated by one particular ethnicity or the government ought to reflect that. And so the reason you can't get an easy political solution is you have three different groups who want a government that looks very different. And that's where there has been far less headway made in the political negotiations than ideally would have been done.
According to General Robert Gard, who was on my show the other week, Sunnis and Shiites are unanimous in wanting the United States to go away.
Well, that yes, in that piece, and I was talking more about what their political solution would look like. I think there is a sense in Iraq that most people would like the U.S. to go away. The problem is most people also want to prevent a return to violence. And the real question is what happens if the U.S. does pull out? And if the U.S. pulls out entirely, my fear is that you would then see the insurgents who right now have been biding their time, it's not that they've disappeared or been arrested or been brought into the political process, come back in greater force than they were. On one hand, it would be nice to say, okay, now if the Iraqis want us to leave, we can just do that. The problem is, what is the consequence of doing that? And that's, in a sense, it's anybody's guess. But there's no evidence to say that the insurgents have been brought into a political process which would give them reason not to go back to being violent if the U.S. were to leave. And so while I agree with the general, I also am not sure that option wouldn't have some serious consequences in terms of the levels of violence on the ground in Baghdad and elsewhere.
So let's talk about Afghanistan. Afghanistan is rarely in the news compared to Iraq and certainly Iran. But a lot of our tax money is going into doing, well, what?
Well, the problem with Afghanistan is that when we decided in 2003 to go to war in Iraq, or maybe they decided that long before 2003, they essentially forgot about Afghanistan. And Afghanistan was, under the Taliban, essentially a failed state in the sense that the government was really unable to provide basic services to the country. And unfortunately, 6 years later, the government is still unable to provide basic services in most of the country. The government in Kabul, with U.S. support, is essentially running Kabul and not running the rest of Afghanistan. And there are still al-Qaeda members at large in Afghanistan. And we have done very, very little to try to change the ability of the government to assist in Afghanistan. And we're seeing more and more the government relying on poppies and hence opium as its source of revenue. So we are spending taxpayers' dollars both to keep a minimal military force in Afghanistan and to engage in some reconstruction efforts, but we have done far too little and far too slowly. It would be really nice, and frankly it wouldn't have been very hard, for at the end of 2007 us to be able to declare Afghanistan a great success story. It would be a far easier country to have fixed than Iraq, and I could certainly imagine, and an effective government and the quality of people's lives increasing dramatically. But instead of focusing on Afghanistan, where there was reason to focus after September 11th, we undertook Iraq and forgot about Afghanistan. And I think Afghanistan will continue to be forgotten about. We've largely left it to some of our European partners to take the lead there. And no one's doing enough. And I think there's a real possibility that Afghanistan will not have a meaningful functioning government throughout the country anytime in the foreseeable future. So I think Afghanistan, if we had to sort of say where are we at the end of this year and where we could have been, is really the story of missed opportunity.
Let's turn to Iran. Iran turns out not to have a nuclear weapons program, according to the unanimous assessment of all 16 United States intelligence agencies. What does that mean, and where does our foreign policy stand in relation to the country of Iran?
Well, a year ago, the Bush administration was in the midst of ratcheting up the rhetoric, and it seemed preparing for war with Iran. I think at the end of the year, we have to say that that was all once again based on faulty intelligence or misuse of the intelligence that was there. Perhaps one of the lessons that we finally learned from Iraq is to let the intelligence professionals speak, and they may actually get it right if the government and the political officials listen to them. So on one hand, there's a success story of the intelligence officials finally getting it right. It appears that the Iraqi government ceased its nuclear weapons program, and I think we no longer have the kind of evidence that would support not the legality, but the practical need for an intervention that certainly some members of the Bush administration were trying to find a year ago. I don't think the situation with Iran, however, is something we can just say, we got it wrong and now everything's fine. And there's a couple reasons for that. On the nuclear issue, what all of the intelligence that we now have says is that the Iranians have stopped their nuclear weapons program, but not their civilian nuclear program. And they have, in fact, been advancing with some success in terms of their civilian nuclear weapons program for use, for example, in generating power. The problem is it is very easy, and we've talked about this, I think, before on the air, to move from a civilian nuclear program to a weapons program. Once you have the technology to refine uranium to use in a nuclear reactor to make energy, it's not that much of a step to weaponize it. So I think we still have to pay very close attention to what the Iranians are doing in the nuclear area. On the human rights side of things, the situation in Iran has gotten worse over the last year, not better. The Ahmadinejad regime has continued to crack down on human rights and freedom of expression. I have a number of friends in Iran who report that the number of women being picked up and arrested because their apparel might have an overcoat that's a little bit too short, perhaps it doesn't come below the knees, or their veil doesn't cover every bit of hair. So I think on the human rights side, there's real reason to be concerned about Iran. I think the real question in Iran now will be what does political change both in the United States, which will happen next year, and in Iran, which will happen a year from now as well, actually a year and a half from now, what does that mean for the nature of the U.S.-Iranian relationship? And I think there's a real door that could open if a more liberal president is elected in Iran and someone who is willing to at least begin talking seriously with the Iranians on the U.S. side, we could see some change. But until then, we ought to be monitoring Iran very, very carefully.
One thing that I found a little bit perplexing is people talk about Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, as if he were the person in charge of Iran. But the person in charge of Iran is really the supreme leader, along with the Guardian Council, from whom we never hear anything, and who I think, correct me if I'm wrong, are a little bit less hardline than Ahmadinejad.
Yeah, there's been this very funny reversal in the Ahmadinejad presidency, which is that prior to Ahmadinejad, the Guardian Council and the Supreme Leader were the most conservative forces in Iran, and the former president, Khatami, was the more liberal force. And as Ahmadinejad has been president, that has switched, Ahmadinejad being far more hardline and conservative than it appears that the Guardian Council and the Supreme Leader are. And that, I think, has created some rifts within the Iranian government, which is probably a good thing for the United States. The problem is it's very hard to really understand what the Guardian Council and the Supreme Leader want. They're not the ones running around the world making speeches or on television, but you're right that they are, at the end of the day, the most powerful force in Iran. Much of the military reports to them. Should Iran ever develop nuclear weapons, they would have control over the nuclear weapons. So it's not to say that Ahmadinejad is just a figurehead to be ignored. But if you think about it in comparison to the United States, the U.S. president is not omnipotent. He can't do anything he wants. Congress is there to provide a check. And in Iran, that check is provided by the Supreme Leader and the Guardian Council. And in fact, Ahmadinejad is in a far weaker position as the president of Iran than, say, the president of the United States. It's not a figurehead position, but it's one in which almost anything seriously that he wants to do has to be approved by the Supreme Leader and the Guardian Council. So we ought not to think of him as really able to completely dictate Iranian policy. He has some leeway in the foreign policy area. But there is this check imposed on him by the Guardian Council. And we ought to, I think, as we look at how to move forward, recognize that if we're going to really start to try to open things up with Iran, we have to bring some members of the council and even the Supreme Leader into our thinking on that, because at the end of the day, they're the ones who will decide what the future of Iran really looks like.
Well, speaking of the leaders of countries and the checks on their power or lack thereof, let's move over to Pakistan. What's happening there?
Well, we talked in September about Musharraf's very precarious political position at that time, and since then what we've seen play out is Musharraf getting in more and more difficult political waters to the point where it looked for a while like he might be forced out of power. He had then imposed martial law and cracked down on the opposition. Finally, he stepped down from his position as commander of the military and no longer wears his military uniform, but has stayed in power and now withdrawn martial law. But what we have now in Pakistan is a far, far weaker Musharraf, a Musharraf who no longer can run the country on his own. He is, to some degree now, at the whim of the generals, who could kick him out if they wanted to. That's the way power has always changed hands in the past in Pakistan. And also a Musharraf who really needs the support of some of the opposition groups, such as that run by Benazir Bhutto. And so we now we'll have to see Musharraf compromising and engaging in real politics. I think at the end of the day this is a good thing in that it makes room in Pakistan for something that looks more like democracy than what we had under Musharraf as both president and general. The danger is democracy can cut both ways. There are very strong conservative currents in Pakistan, and if that was to be the democratic force that emerged, we could have a country that is no longer an ally in the war on terror, but rather a real threat. So I am hopeful that a democratizing Pakistan will be good for the United States, but it has the potential to swing the other way as Musharraf presumably falls from power or at least declines in influence over the coming years.
What does the word conservative mean when you're talking about Pakistan?
Religious, essentially. Musharraf and the generals, even if they may be of the Muslim faith, tend to be secular in their approach. They are not guided or driven by religious principles, and the conservative forces in Pakistan are essentially religious movements or religious political movements that would rather see a much more religious-dominated state than a secular one where the military is the final arbiter of power.
We're talking to Bill Burke White. He's our foreign correspondent, and we're doing the end of the year foreign policy roundup. Let's take a quick trip to Russia. What's happening there? They've just had some elections.
Yes. Over the last year, we have seen the apex of the power of Vladimir Putin. He is now in his final month as president of Russia, unable to run for another term under the Russian Constitution, but more popular than ever, and essentially adored in a cult of personality that looks a little like the cult of personality that surrounded the likes of Lenin or Stalin back in the day. There were just parliamentary elections in which there was a landslide victory for Putin's party and the governmental party. And he has just named someone by the name of Medvedev to be the next candidate for president on that party's ticket. Medvedev will win the election scheduled for March, hands down. The real question is what role Putin will continue to play. There's been talk of him being prime minister. There's been talk of him simply sitting behind the stage being puppet master of the show. Putin will not go away. There's real concern, I think, about whether there'll be any meaningful handover of power. We've also continued to see a decline in terms of human rights in Russia, in terms of Russia having a much more vigorous and confrontational foreign policy, and using its energy resources as a weapon in foreign policy. So I think Russia has come back onto the stage in the last year as a possible threat to the United States, or at least a meaningful foreign policy power to be contended with, and one that we're going to have to pay much more attention to going forward. So we're going to hear a lot more about Putin, and I think Russia, which had disappeared from the world map for a decade, is now back using oil and natural gas as its weapons rather than, its nuclear arsenal or the Red Army.
So one thing that we haven't really talked about that much and that is not in the press nearly as much as the folks on the east side of the Atlantic Ocean, Latin America. What's happening in Venezuela, Argentina? What's happening south of, in this hemisphere?
There have been a lot of developments in Latin America in the last few months and even the last few days. A couple of success stories. The biggest success story may be economic, which is that the Argentine economy is now booming again after the 2001-2002 economic collapse. Brazil is doing very well economically. There has just been a new presidential election in Argentina. The former president, Néstor Kirchner, decided not to run for a second term. Usually second-term presidents in Argentina are lame ducks from the first day. Instead, his wife was elected president, so a trend that might happen also in the United States now. But we have a former president handing power to his wife, and the new Kirchner will run Argentina, and that seems to be a good thing. She's well-liked and well-respected and has a very independent and positive set of foreign policy goals. So I think Argentina is a success story. We've also seen what I believe are positive developments in Venezuela. Venezuela, of course, is run by President Hugo Chavez, about whom there are competing versions of how to think of him. On one hand, he has brought the country back to the people with a very populist domestic policy and tried to redistribute wealth in some important ways. On the other hand, he has amassed a great deal of power and limited human rights in some important ways. And he put a referendum to the people that would have greatly expanded his power and completely gotten rid of any term limits on his presidency. And interestingly, he lost that referendum. He could have, presumably, manipulated the election to have won it, and he didn't. So I think that tells us something about Chavez that maybe we didn't realize before, which is that there may be more internal checks on his own thinking about his power than we might have thought. And it also means that there is more likelihood that over time There will be a power transition in Venezuela. So I think all of that is a good thing, and even if you like Chavez, it's not good to have one person stay president forever. So I think that's certainly a benefit. So Latin America, I think things are good generally. Of course, there's environmental problems and indigenous rights problems and so forth that we could spend hours on. But as a whole, I think things are looking up in Latin America.
In contrast to the continent of Africa.
Africa remains a basket case, to say the best, I guess. Earlier this month, there was a summit of the European and African leaders in Portugal, and it was a bit of a debacle in large part because Robert Mugabe, the president slash dictator of Zimbabwe, was invited and turned up. And the situation in Africa remains very bad. There's still war in much of the continent, economic problems perhaps everywhere, and everyone seems to have essentially forgotten about Africa save the Chinese. And the Chinese now are everywhere in Africa. They're investing a huge amount of money, largely in resource extraction, entering into contracts to lock up oil reserves, mining rights and so forth throughout the country, bringing in Chinese workers to do that mining, so not passing off a lot of skills or resources to the local populations. And what we now see is, whereas 150 years ago, the European powers essentially had a mercantilist foreign policy in Africa. In other words, go down, exploit, and take back to benefit your own economy a bunch of resources. The Chinese are now doing that. Well, the rest of us sit aside and seem to ignore the continent.
Speaking of China, you're going to be going there, so we're going to be doing more on China in the new year. But a brief overview, what's happening in China, and particularly in relationship to the United States?
Well, China has emerged as, really the primary foreign policy, foreign affairs power in the world after the United States now. And maybe a year ago that was still happening. I think now China is there. And it's interesting. China has, on one hand, sought to be a legitimate and even helpful player in foreign policy, but it also has its own image of what the world ought to look like, and that's one that's certainly not dominated by the United States. And so we're going to have to figure out how to work with China going forward. It is developing its navy so that it can project power outward more. It's tying up relationships and links with countries, particularly in Africa, so that it has more foreign policy clout. And it has extraordinary financial wealth, buying U.S. Dollars in a massive way to give it leverage with the United States, and has major trade surpluses with the U.S. and with Europe. So it has a great deal of power in that sense. The things to be on the lookout for with respect to China going forward are two. First is environmental. There is an environmental catastrophe of the worst order going on in China, which cannot be reported on very much in China, but the environmental problems are extraordinary and could cause maybe not a collapse of the government, but certainly a collapse of the health and environment and living standard of the Chinese people. And second is an economic bubble. The basics aren't there to support the kind of economic growth China has seen. There's a huge amount of investment and building going on, but it could be very well that the Chinese economy either has a hiccup or something far worse. And given how powerful that economy is at the moment, we can no longer ignore that. Should the Chinese economy go into recession and that bubble burst, it would have massive consequences for the global economy. And it seems likely that at some point there's going to be a reversal there. The old adage of what goes up must come down ought to still be true, even as China has boomed.
What about Europe? You are in Europe right now. What kind of changes have we seen? Tony Blair is gone. Gordon Brown is in. What's happening?
Well, I think we've seen a shift in the center of power in Europe. During the Blair years, the United Kingdom was the most important country in Europe. It was where European foreign policy, to the degree that there is such a thing, was being set, and it was the country through whom the United States interfaced with Europe. The two most powerful leaders in Europe now are Angela Merkel in Germany and President Sarkozy here in France, and they now really represent the weight of foreign policy power in Europe. That's not to say that England doesn't matter or that Gordon Brown hasn't been effective, but Brown has tried to distance himself from the United States, while Sarkozy and Merkel, I think, have come closer to the United States. So I think we find that we still have a special relationship with the United Kingdom, but that if we want to accomplish something and work with our European partners, the road now leads through Paris and Berlin as much as London. So I think that's an important shift in Europe. The other thing that has happened in Europe, and the Europeans don't want to admit this, but Europe is now fully dependent on Russian exports of natural gas and energy, which means that in confronting or dealing with Russia, the Europeans have a lot less flexibility and freedom than they perhaps would have if they weren't so dependent on Russian gas resources. And I think that's going to play out in a big way as we start figuring out how to deal with a resurgent Russia.
Finally, when we talk about security, quote-unquote, in the United States, what do you think are the security concerns and how do they compare to last year at this time?
Well, I think on the whole, we probably are slightly safer than we were a year ago. And I don't mean safer just in the sense of is there going to be a terrorist attack. I don't think we can ever know what that question completely. But I think Iraq has seen some improvement. As we've talked about, Iran now, I think we're safe that we're not about to go to war there, and that alone, I think, makes us probably safer. I think there are some real concerns, and I think they're largely located in Russia, in China, perhaps in things going worse in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so I think we have to be thinking about our safety and security, not just as to whether the airport screeners are keeping bombs off airplanes, but really about how we're perceived in the world and how we're interacting with and trying to support positive developments in these other countries, which is either where terrorism starts on that front, but also where the challenges to the U.S. security might come from. And the biggest one that we haven't talked about now, but I think we still have to really address, is the Middle East. If we don't get the situation in Israel and Palestine solved, I don't think you can come up with a broader solution in the Middle East, so that ought to be high on the agenda. But we have to really be thinking about our foreign policy globally, not just our security at home.
Bill Burke-White, I want to thank you so much for being with us. There's much more to talk about, but we will talk about a lot of it in the new year. Thanks for speaking to us from Paris.
Until then, happy holidays and glad to be with you.
Same to you, Bill. Bill Burke-White. Thank you. Is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the book New Mexico's Crypto Jews. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Carrie Hertz. She is a photographer and author of the book New Mexico's Crypto Jews, Image and Memory, published by the University of New Mexico Press. And she will be speaking and signing books tomorrow, Thursday, December 20th, at Garcia Street Books in Santa Fe at 5 in the afternoon. Welcome.
Hello. How are you doing?
Great to have you. Wonderful book of photography and stories. Who were, for those who still don't know, who were and are the Crypto Jews of New Mexico?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but basically they're descendants of the New Mexicans who came over with the conquistadors in the 16th and 17th century to settle Mexico, and then what was New Spain. New Mexico was part of New Spain. So these are descendants who have some remnants of their culture, spiritual identity, customs, sometimes no customs, and they just have found out about it. So I don't know if that explains who they are.
Well, did they, when they came to the New World way back when, did they hope to find religious freedom, or were they also forced to convert to Catholicism, or what was the story?
Well, the Inquisition forced the Jews and the Moors in 1492, approximately, to either convert to Catholicism or leave. Many people converted. The Moors went mostly over to the African side of you know, just across the water, Jews either left as Jews and went to Greece and Italy, places like that, Amsterdam, and others converted. So they were called New Christians, and they basically stayed New Christians. Many of them blended completely into the culture. Others moved to Portugal for a while as New Christians and practiced their Judaism in secret. And then sort of somehow you couldn't come over here if you were a Muslim or a Jew on a boat with Oñate or any of the other conquistadors. You had to be Christian. So that's who they were, basically.
So recreating this history, it's like putting together, in New Mexico, like putting together a puzzle where a lot of the pieces are lost. What evidence remains of this history?
Well, there is cultural memory, some customs, like circumcision, which nobody else did, basically. There's family foods that they didn't eat, like pork. Sometimes people would remember a grandmother lighting candles on Friday night, and that's all. There's records of people I've spoken to remember covering the mirrors when somebody died, which is a Jewish custom. You know, all those things are not necessarily make one Jewish, but they sort of remnants of what part of Jewish practices were. This is getting hard for me.
Yeah, well, it's such an interesting question in New Mexico, because in the 17 years that I've lived here, there's been, I think, an ever-increasing openness among New Mexicans, among New Mexican crypto-Jews about, so to speak, coming out or really acknowledging this and exploring this part of their heritage.
Correct. And I think it has made it easier. I mean, I tried to do this book, you know, 15 years ago, and I only had a few people, and it's taken all of this time to sort of build trust and maybe a younger generation, though many people are in their 50s, so, you know, I guess that's younger than their grandparents, but are willing to speak about it. I have one woman who finally let me take her photograph with her sons, but then in the end I couldn't use the last name, I couldn't use the son's name. You know, so there's still sort of this remnant of, well, I have some old people, I don't want to get them upset or something. And other people are practicing Catholics or other Christian religions, but then still have this memory and have researched their family, and, you know, so they practice sometimes dual practices, or they practice Catholicism and yet acknowledge their cultural past and are interested in what it was all about. So it's kind of it, but people are much more open, I think. Not everybody, but enough that I could actually, you know, photograph, you know, over 30 people. So that's very exciting.
It is, and there are wonderful photographs in this book. I was wondering about the question of identity and to what extent religious identity is, you know, genetic. Your great-great-great-great grandparents were Jews, and therefore you are or you're not. I mean, if the tradition is lost, do people still, who you talk to, still feel themselves to be Jewish once that identity is refound?
That depends on who you talk to. If you talk to the individual, I think that they are rediscovering their past and are either acknowledging it and just going on their daily life, or they've joined some of the synagogues, or there's a Sephardic group meeting at Nahalat Shalom once a month in Albuquerque, and there's also a congregation of sorts down in Las Lunas. So they're getting together and maybe feeling more comfortable among themselves. Though people go, you know, you'll find people in the synagogues who are, you know, New Mexican Hispanics, and they sit there like everybody else and do whatever spiritual needs they have, you know, praying or whatever, or learning more Hebrew. But other people just don't do that. They're just, you know, who they are right now. I mean, we're all kind of complex We have complex spirituality. So many of us have changed what we are also, right? I mean, you can find that in New Mexico.
Good. I mean, Lord knows there's an awful lot of Buddhists and Sikhs and so on who weren't born into those traditions.
Correct. So, but, you know, I think that they're, you know, honoring their ancestors' ordeal and the bravery of the ancestors, and they have known something somehow through, you know, their mother or their fathers, and now we're saying, yes, we can speak out about this. We don't have to hide what's, you know, we're not a little whisper in the dark. And there seems to be a lot of people, and I don't think they just want to be Jewish. I mean, why would anybody want to do that, you know? So, you know.
Except those who convert to Judaism.
Right.
We're talking to Carrie Hertz, who is the author of the book New Mexico's Crypto-Jews, Image and Memory. How did you find the people whose portraits you made in the book?
Well, you know, I think I mentioned I've been doing this for 20 years. I heard about it and couldn't believe it. This was in 1985, and started meeting a few people at some conferences or through other people in New Mexico, and either I would photograph them or not. I did a couple of pieces for the New York Times, and, you know, it was lucky that I had the pictures already of a few people, because you can't just do everything like in one day and just, you know, people, you can't just call them up and say, let's do it, because that's not how it works for them. They have to know who you are. And so it just was sort of a little gathering, and, you know, then I would stop doing it, and then something would come up and somebody, some newspaper or magazine would want one of my photos. So I'd get reinterested. You know, I didn't, you know, make my living off of this. I just sort of, it was sort of my passion. And I just lost my thought. Here we go.
So, I mean, it's such an interesting thing. At first, people were shy about being photographed. What has led to people's letting go of their reticence, do you think?
I think the fact that there have been more articles in the public, you know, in New Mexico or nationally or internationally, and, you know, they finally, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, if you let go of your fear, there's really nothing to fear for at this point, though, you know, families still don't like to talk about it. So I think it's a I don't really know. I mean, but I think it's a combination of people knowing me and other history books coming out and people seeing that they were done with respect. So in 2005, one gentleman finally came up to me. I've known him for 15 or so years. And, he's, you know, I could photograph people at the conference, but that's kind of boring. So I couldn't, you know, photograph them, like do a portrait or something. So he came up and said, well, I've been looking for you, and I finally think we should do this. So it's like, okay, let's go. I'll meet you. You know, we made a date. I think people just sort of realize that it's just part of, everybody has some past, and if you're interested in history, you can investigate that for whoever you are. Some people have investigated it through DNA testing and are practicing priests, so they have, you know, connections, but they still do what they always done, and, you know. Yeah,
it's very interesting. What, at this point in New Mexico, is the relationship like between New Mexican crypto-Jews and then the rest of the non-crypto, so to speak, Jewish community?
Right. I think they're relatively open to it. I think if you in a very Orthodox community, I think that they want you to convert, or they don't, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, you've kind of lost it after all these years. But I'm not I'm a spiritual person, but I'm not a religious person, and I certainly don't write all these rules. So, but I know that in many of the congregations around the state, you know, you show up and you're welcomed, and, you know, there's always some sort of clique everywhere, but I think people can fit in and figure out somehow to fit in and see if they like what that practice is. There's a different, you know, there's the Torah, and everybody follows that, but there are all these different there are different degrees of what people practice. So,
how has this affected you? I mean, you are descended from European Holocaust survivors.
Correct.
What has this project been like for you personally to do?
Well, it's been fun, and it's also made me, you know, just sort of think about those people. I have visited some of my father's village in Germany, which he lived in since the 16th century, his family, and then had to leave, obviously, under duress. It's I don't know, you realize your freedom here, and I don't know, it was great to meet people that could speak about their past, and, you know, it's more a history thing than, I don't know. I still sometimes look over my back because of my upbringing, and that was in New York City, so there were 3 million Jews there. Why should I look over my back? But you sort of have this internal thing that's passed on to you about watching out, you know, because of what happened to your family. So I can relate to people being nervous about telling people their past.
There's a section in the book where you photograph gravestones of various kinds, and it's very interesting because some of the clues that this was a New Mexico crypto Jew are hidden. For example, a six pointed flower instead of a six pointed star,
right.
And then some of them are more overt.
Right. The cemetery project is kind of how I started. I had seen somebody else who had taken some pictures, and so I started looking for them. And that was in the late 80s, 1980s, through the 90s. And, you know, this is what descendants have told me and told other people about the six-pointed stars or the lilies. And I just have, you know, this is what they know. This is what their families, I mean, some of the grave sites are in the family, where the families are. So this is what they told me. Now, whether, you know, some iconographer, I guess would be maybe the right word, would have to really, you know, you'd have to actually go ask somebody who buried that person or who was a direct relative, what it all meant. But I sort of tried to photograph it. So it wasn't always so clear. It was a little mysterious. You could read some of it. You couldn't read all of it. And, you know, just sort of make it part of this whole search, quest, mystery that the people have looked at. And see it maybe through, you know, their eyes. And I want the reader or the viewer to kind of interpret it for themselves. I mean, I'm not a historian. I'm just a photographer, so.
But there's some very interesting things in there. For example, some things I didn't know about last names. So the last name, mm-hmm. Rael, is or may be from Israel. Or some of the last names, like Montaño and so on, could be taken from names that are basically changed from originally Jewish names, and you take on the names of forms in nature.
Correct. And again, you know, I'm not a sociologist, historian, or this is what I've been told. So I kind of wanted to show what people are believing, you know, and one will have to do more investigation and look into that kind of stuff. But many people say this, so I just don't want to be the one that, I'm just showing it. I'm not necessarily, I guess it's a way of saying it, but I don't want to be quoted as saying this is the definitive, you know, you still have to speak to the families. One of the gravestones was very interesting. The man had two military gravestones They were both white. You can see them up in the Santa Fe Cemetery, these big white stones that are made by the Veterans Administration in Washington. And you write away, and you have to check off what marker you want on it. So you can check, you know, a cross or a Jewish star or nothing, and maybe there's some other choices. And apparently two relatives of Alessandro Moyes's Padilla, who seems to have two names. His other name is Alex M. Padilla, and the same death, the same Navy years he was in the Navy in Korea. Two relatives ordered these stones separately, and one came back with a Jewish star, and one came back with a Catholic cross on it, and then they put them both up in the same place. So it's like, oh, this is very interesting.
Truly divided identity.
Correct. And, you know, one relative saw it one way, one saw it the other. And
well, unfortunately, yeah. it's actually time to go right now.
That's fine.
But Carrie Hertz, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Photographer Carrie Hertz is the author of New Mexico's Crypto Jews, Image and Memory, published by the University of New Mexico Press. And she will be speaking and signing books tomorrow, Thursday, December 20th, at Garcia Street Books, right here in Santa Fe at 5 in the afternoon. You've
okay.
been very
Thank
nice
you.
To have you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan presents the monthly New Orleans Hour, and Giants of Jazz takes a holiday for the holidays and presents 6 centuries of holiday music. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.